Hey there. Welcome to one of our first stories of the podcast. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. In season three, we shouldered up with you and made it clear that this podcast is not for sale. No advertising or outside influence, a sacred and safe space. Starting with season three, we dedicate a poem to one of our listeners that is standing with us as an enabler of our mission. They're doing so by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. To be true to our word, we're going back through some of our earlier content in seasons one and two and removing the segments that we feel may not be congruent with this idea. So enjoy. This story, like every other story on our podcast, is now 100% advertising free. A safe space where you can let your guard down, listen, and notice if something comes up in your soul. If you would like to be an enabler, and we certainly could use your help, visit bellystory.com and chip in $5 today. Now, here's that extraordinary life story.
Light bulb went off. Man, that's what I'm doing. I'm running around trying to save the world and not taking a look. All I can do is take... I'm powerless over people, places, and things. All I can do is take care of me. And I went right up to the nurse and said, I'm a drug addict, alcoholic. Put me up on the drug ward, you know? And they did.
This podcast is about the time we all get knocked down in life and climb up a new person. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts. Let me introduce you to Scotty Brown. Scotty lives near Los Angeles, but his story centers around his rough and tumble days in Chicago. At a very young age, Scotty was a drug kingpin by day and a rock and roll partier by night. This lifestyle caught up with him, and getting out wasn't as easy as it might seem. Several decades later, and sober for that same amount of time, Scotty's story and ongoing work in addiction and recovery has touched thousands of lives. We are pleased that he's sharing it with us today. Oh, before we get started, please know that some of the conversations about drug use might be triggering. So please make the choice to listen responsibly. Scotty Brown, welcome to Belly of the Beast Life Stories.
Hello, my friend.
Scotty.
Yes.
So take us back. You wake up in a mental institution.
Yeah, that's never fun, especially when there's some Pakistani guy looking down at you. And I'm like, do you have to wake me up every 2 hours? Because they were checking to see if I was suicidal or not. And I finally woke up, went into the waiting room or whatever, breakfast room, grabbed a banana, thought I would eat it, but couldn't, thought it might be poisoned. Asked a kid my age, what are you doing here? Why are you in here? He said, my doctor told me I can't talk about it. I said, okay. So I walked away from him, saw an older guy. I thought he was my mom's therapist planted in there because I was a little paranoid. So I went up to him. I said, why are you in here? He said, my doctor told me I can't talk about it. I'm like, that's it. I'm out of here. Went to the payphone, called my mother. I said, Ma, I'm in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And if you don't get me the F out of here, I'm going to have you effing murdered. So she wasn't very happy about hearing that. And I said, I'm serious, Mom. Get me the hell out of here or else. So she was crying. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I'm telling you what to do. So at that moment, well, right before that, I went to all the doors, and they wouldn't open. And then I went to the windows, and they wouldn't open. And I thought, the devil has me right where he wants me, you know? That's when I went to the payphone, and I called her. Well, at that moment then, two maids were coming through one of the locked doors, and I bolted through, and I had $3,000 in my pocket. I pulled it out, and I said, I showed it to the maids. I said, get me out of here. You know, I'll give you this money. And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, then tell me what direction to run. Because it was really only like a stairway that I remember going up. And The one pointed up the stairs, so I started running up there. And that's just, at this time, they saw I was trying to escape. And one of the techs or whatever came through a locked door with this kid, Cosmo. We called him. He was about 18 and about 6'4". Big kid. And they're like, come on down. And I'm like, no, man, I want to get the hell out of here. You know, I'm here. I go, I'm here to save you guys. And Cosmo's like, come on down, man. And this is the kid I saw right when I walked in this joint at 4 a.m. doing the Thorazine shuffle down the hallway, you know. That's never good to see in a psych ward. So he had the robe on, you know, or whatever, the gown, doing the Thorazine shuffle. And I'm like, dude, I'm here to save you. Because at this moment in time in my life, I thought I was the savior of the world, the second coming. And that's never a good thing. That's a lot of stress, you know.
How old were you?
24, just turned. It was August 17th, 1984.
Take us back to this period of time in your life. You said that you were a drug kingpin by day and a punk rocker at night.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
So this is rough and tumble.
Yeah, I was making a lot of money, and then I was going out and celebrating by slam dancing. You know, just living a fast life, you know. I love music. I always did. Music's like a natural high to me. And, you know, I'd make the money during the day and then go out and buy everybody drinks and, you know, go out looking for a fight and the fuck, you know. It was good times.
They called you downtown Scotty Brown?
Not then. I was Scotty Spoiled then. No, actually I did have the name downtown then. My punk rock name was Scotty Spoiled because I made so much freaking money and I was spoiled. Then I bought a condo at 21 East Chestnut in Chicago. And my buddy Ricky Reardon started calling me downtown. That was 1980. I was 19 or 20. And I bought a condo down there. So that's how I got that nickname.
So you're making a lot of money at a very young age,
mm-hmm.
selling drugs.
Yeah, marijuana.
And you got involved with the Chicago Mafia?
You know, I lived across the street from them. The Amabile brothers, their dad was a hitman. He was in prison. And, you know, Capone's and Nitty's, I played bass. You know, I really know that we know Capone. But anyway, that was just what it was. And I played baseball with these kids. But the thing is, I started smoking pot before any of them. So I would sell it to them. And then what happened was the parents, the mobsters, they weren't making the money like we were. We were selling drugs. They were against drugs. They were selling stolen goods and jewelry. And it was a joke, betting on horses or whatever. And we started selling marijuana and making a lot of money. So, but the kids of those guys, they, a couple of them were pretty successful in the business, like myself. I was a good salesman. So, yeah, I worked with them. And, you know, I guess you could say we were all mobbed up, you know. You just fall into it by doing that enterprise, you know, criminal. It all started like for fun, and I thought it would be short term. I was really around the Woodstock era time and make love, not war. And the kids that came from broken homes seemed to fall into that, more of that drug lifestyle and things like that. So I kind of liked it, and I liked being the popular kid that can get the drugs for you. And I would sell them at a Forest Preserve, Bussy Woods, and a guy came up to me one day. He said, kid, you want more? And I go, of course. Took me to a house. Next thing I know, it's like a safe house for Colombians or whoever, and it had about a ton of weed in it. I'd never seen that much weed. And he said, well, take a bale. It was 50-pound bale, and that's what started really going to, you know, where I was really doing well. I had about 50 clients at the time. I was 17 or 18 right out of high school. I might have still been in high school. I quit high school, though. And then I realized I have too many clients. So the thing that really helped my business was I said, you know, I'm just going to take 5 of my best guys and give them 10 clients apiece, and then I'll just have to deal with 5 people. And that was what really made it take off, and also meeting those guys that lived at the safe house, you know. So it was fun, you know, and then I also had other connections, and but they would call me, and I'd be one of the first ones at the house when the load came in and go through all the bales. I'd pick the best ones, you know, see if any were more like golden, Colombian gold or whatever back then.
At some point, all of those good times kind of slow down or abruptly stop?
Well, I always knew I drank and used a lot, so I tried not to do it, you know, especially when I was working. Especially I was smoking pot, I forget. I remember I'd be like, there were times when I left like $100,000 at someone's house. Oh, shit. You know, hey, I left the money there, right? You know what I mean? And be like, oh, man, I got to quit smoking pot while I'm doing deals, you know? And so I try not to use during the day, but I did party. And then eventually, you know, what I thought was fun in games, you know, became a career, you know? And I realized that. So that the fact of that and the fear and stuff, yeah, I started partying hard, you know, staying up all night. The clubs were open till 4 or 5 in the morning, and we lock the front door and keep them open till noon. You go out the back, you know. So that was a lot of fun until it wasn't. It all catches up to you, you know. I had all the time in the world to do it. And then cocaine came around, and I never really liked it that much. I'd be joking. I'd be like doing a line and going, I hate this. You know, but you're so drunk and high, you want to feel different, you know? So it was around my birthday in 1984 that I started doing too much of that shit. And asking, it'd be so high, I'd be like, God help me, please bring me down. I'll never do it again. I know I said that last week. And like the third time, I'm like, man, I'm powerless over this, you know?
How old were you?
23. 22 at this, probably the beginning. I mean, you know, I started doing coke at 19, but I never liked it and I never sold it. I sold it in the beginning and it never went well. People calling you for it morning, can I get more? They'd be all jacked out. And I was like, man, I don't like, if I'm not going to do it, I don't want to sell it, you know? Be like a hypocrite then. So I kind of stuck with the reefer. But the coke, you know, everybody was selling more and more. My guys were always getting it, obviously. But I didn't want to buy it. But I knew eventually it was going to be more about the money and the career. And it's a lot easier to transport and things like that. So I felt like I was falling into that, and I didn't like that either. And then I started doing it. Even though I didn't like doing it, I would do it. And then I'd be like, man, I'm so high. I would get paranoid immediately on that stuff.
Where was the mafia on this?
In my head, chasing me. You know, the mafia, I felt like I'm part of the mob. You know, we're a group of guys that get together. Doesn't matter what nationality you are or anything like that. We're in a criminal enterprise, and we don't want anyone to know, and we're the mob.
Okay, so you're 22, 23, and you're starting to think it's time for a change.
You know, I probably always thought I wanted to change. What I did was move to San Francisco. I got a place there because I was getting so much money in toys. I wanted to enjoy my toys. You know, I had a Mercedes convertible and this and that. And so I was like, well, I'll move to San Francisco. Haight & Ashbury, which became more punk rock back then. And I went to this club called the I-Beam, which and not only that, the clubs closed early at 2 a.m. And I thought, oh, I'm going to live a healthier lifestyle. They all eat like health food over there. I'm going to become healthy and do good and be a good kid, because I realized the partying was getting to me. So I got a place there and I kept my toys there and spent my money there. So I just felt like I fit in more as a drug addict in San Francisco. And I would just fly back to Chicago every month or so and supply everybody and get the hell out of town, you know? So that was a change. But then when I realized, I started meeting people there and going up to Mendocino and going to the pot farms there and talking to everybody and getting into the coke there, you know, because that was like a port city, so there's a lot of stuff coming in there. And that's when it kind of, you know, that's where I pretty much bottomed out over there. and realized wherever I went, there I was. I couldn't escape myself.
Can you explain that for us?
Well, you know, I'm trying not to use. I'm overdoing it. You know, I would go out and say, oh, we're just going to drink tonight. I was getting into thinking I'm a wine connoisseur too. Going up to Napa and shit, you know. Oh, yeah, look at that. Look at the rings on, or the legs on that wine. You know, okay, pour it. You know, act like a big shot. But playing the big shot in cheap bar rooms, we say, and started saying, oh, we're just going to go drink wine or beer or whatever. And next thing you know, be so drunk. Do a couple bumps, you know. Then I'm off to the races. So I tried to escape all that by traveling and just realized my problems were still here, you know, with me. I couldn't escape it. The using, the drugs, wherever, everywhere I went, you know.
So would the bottom be the mental institution?
Yeah. Well, a little before that, I was once again doing the coke after promising me and my buddy, we're not going to do it. A friend of mine just gave me a whole shitload of it, and I was like, oh, might as well do it. Ended up doing it, too much of it, of course, and I was praying to God, please let me live. I'll never do it again. I know I said that last week, but I had a moment of clarity. I pictured my mother at my funeral and me feeling spiritually bankrupt. And I'm like, I don't want to feel this way. I don't want to die this way, right? And I just took from the world. Everything was about me, take, take, take. My nickname was Boss of the World, you know? And I felt, oh, great. What I've been promoting for 10 years is now killing me. And I felt a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. And I didn't really know what to do. I thought I had to save the world. Like, oh, now, okay, you have all this insight. You had this moment of clarity. You got to save the world now. You got to tell everybody not to behave that way. And I ran around trying to do that. You know, when you're trying to save the world, it's kind of difficult to sleep. And then when you're not sleeping and you're paranoid and trying not to use and you got this ism in your head, and next thing I know, you know, the devil's chasing me and it's on, you know, it's like a war. Maybe this war is just in my own head, you know, I don't know, but it was on and I was fighting it and it was everywhere and I couldn't escape it. Like I said, wherever I went, there I was, there it was. And I didn't really know how to change, you know. I'm glad that I got put in. I went to my parents and said, look, I took them to an Italian restaurant in my neighborhood. You know, Bloomingdale over there, Amalfi's, and it was our hangout, and took my mom and my brother, and I told them, you know, I'm savior of the world, and the devil's after me, and he's going to be coming for you too. My brother got up and went outside and threw up. Obviously, they were very afraid. They knew what I'd been doing all these years. Then I went to my dad, and I had to make a call on a payphone, so I went and got two rolls of quarters. I remember being at a gas station tipping the guy, you know, $80 for two rolls of quarters or whatever it was, and he's on the loudspeaker, hey buddy, thanks. And I'm calling wherever to make a drug deal because I had a load coming in, and on the payphone with my quarters, and walking to the phone, this guy Angelo Lagos pulls up in his Cadillac. He's like, Scotty Brown, what's up? And I'm thinking he's part of the devil's team. I'm like, hey, I got my two rolls of quarters in my fist, right? I'm waiting for you guys. I'm ready for you guys, you know? Total insanity. And I look at my mom and my brother, and they're standing outside of the car. I'm like, I wonder why they're outside of the car. They told me, you know, a year or two later that they thought I was going to murder them. So I made my call. I went to my dad's, and they had warned him I was coming. So he had called the minister, and he came over and talked me into going into the psych ward. So I was like, fine, I'll go in there. I'm telling you, I know what's going on here. The devil wants me dead. The war is on, right? And I'm fighting it. So he talked me going into the psych ward, which was around 2 or 4 a.m. in the morning walked in there, saw Cosmo walking around, right? I said, I'm going in voluntarily. I want to leave voluntarily. They said, okay. Well, obviously, when I wasn't able to leave voluntarily, I was pissed. So that leads us back to the beginning of the story, right?
So, Scotty, I'd love for you to tell us sort of at what moment did you surrender?
They kept telling me that, you know, maybe I was a drug addict and an alcoholic. I said, no. I didn't have it in the house, and I didn't think I was, but, you know, I pretty much slept till 4 p.m., went out, did a little happy hour, but my life was unmanageable, but I didn't want to accept it. And then when they kept telling me, well, we're waiting for beds to open up in the drug rehab part of the hospital. And I'm like, all right, whatever, you know, whatever you want. I don't even want to be in here. And I kept trying to get out. And then they'd see me in a good mood. I would sign a 5-day thing where you could get out and go to court or whatever. And then they'd see, if I was feeling better, they'd go, you don't really want to leave right now. And I go, no, fine, okay. And I signed it. And so they kept telling me, look, you're powerless over people, places, and things. All you can do is take care of yourself. And I was in these little therapy groups, and then I was taught, believe it or not, I was talking to an anorexic girl, and she was very, very skinny and sick. She told me she'd been running around trying to take care of her mom. Her dad died. Her brother was sick. She wasn't taking care of herself. She was like 80 pounds. I took one look at her. I go, man, you're not taking care of yourself, you know? And it just clicked, you know, like a light bulb went off. Man, that's what I'm doing. I'm running around trying to save the world and not taking a look. All I can do is I'm powerless over people, places, and things. All I can do is take care of me. And I went right up to the nurse and said, I'm a drug addict, alcoholic, put me up on the drug ward, you know? And they did. And it was like his biggest weight lifted off my shoulder that I didn't have to save the world. All I had to do is change me and maybe my life could get better. And I read this thing that could be insane, right? And I said, I'm not insane. You know, my life's unmanageable and things like that. But it said sanity is soundness of mind. I go, well, I have none of that. I can't sleep. My mind is full of craziness and anxiety and the devil, and everyone's chasing me, and I'm seeing it in people. And I went up to the drug ward, and there was plenty of beds available. They were just waiting for me to admit it. And started.
So how long were you in the drug rehab?
35 days or so, you know. They didn't count the psych ward days, so.
So I'm wondering just how you're thinking about life without drugs and substances.
Well, I was almost relieved, you know, that, wow, we can say that this is a problem. That's a first step to get better. I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. The scariest part, though, was I made a living out of it, right? So I just felt like I had to live an honest lifestyle. I mean, all my feelings were coming back tenfold, which wasn't good. I looked in the mirror and cried. Look what you did for 10 years. 10 years before this, I got robbed in a drug deal. I was 14. I borrowed money from the Hell's Angels. Hell's Henchmen, actually. They became angels later. But I borrowed money. My friend's brother was in the club, and I told these older guys, were like, we can get whatever you want. Get as much money as possible. Like a dumbass kid, I took all my paper route money. I worked hard on that paper route, you know what I mean? I took my whole life savings at that time at 14 and borrowed money from the henchmen and did the steal, and they robbed me. And they dropped me off at Mannheimer Road, which was a bad neighborhood outside of where I lived, you know, and went to a payphone and called my friend to pick me up. And I was obviously super, super upset and scared and wanted to kill these guys. I just thought if I had a shotgun, I would have shot them.
So you're reliving all these experiences, all these like very negative, dark
moments.
Well,
what happened was when I got home, I looked in the mirror that day when I got robbed and said, that's never going to happen to me again. You're going to be a badass dude, right? You're not going to let shit like that happen to you. And now 10 years later, I'm looking in the mirror going, wow, look at you now, right? Yeah, it worked out financially or whatever, but your life is over if you don't change. You have no serenity. It's jails, institution, and death. And I looked in the mirror. It was like these two mirrors, you know? Wow, look, how are you going to get your ass out of this fucking hole, you know? I was in deep. I didn't like people leaving the crew, you know? So I'm thinking they're thinking like I thought. You know, somebody got caught or something, it'd be nice if he wasn't around. Cheers, right? Be in a fancy restaurant. Dom Perignon, there's my drink. Anyway, it was scary, you know,
to get out.
I prayed to God to kill me. I did. I remember hearing Bob Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Door saying, God, I'm ready to come. I'm a changed man. It's been like a week. I'm changed. Please kill me in here. And let me not have to deal with the outside world. Because I knew I was going to have to make changes. And it wasn't going to be hard. Easy, I mean.
Do you remember the first day that you walked out?
When I was released, you know what I remember? Putting my seatbelt on. I never did that before. I put my seatbelt on. They released me to a three-quarter way house. I walked in this three-quarter way house. It had a big newspaper clippings on the wall. Brown quits drinking. Distilleries shut down. The guy who lived there, his name was Brown too. So I thought that was funny. But I lived next to a mustard scene in Chicago. I stayed there like two nights. I'm like, I'm going home. I want this thing. You know, I was very fortunate to be rocketed into the fourth dimension. I had a whole new lease on life. I saw flowers for the first time. I smelled the flowers. My life was so different. Everything was like beautiful in a lot of ways. I just knew, you know, it was still scary. So I hid out. I hid out in the mustard seed at times. And
so let's go back to you hiding out in mm-hmm. the mustard seed.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, you're sober.
Mm-hmm.
No drugs, no alcohol.
No.
People aren't even trying to give you drugs or
they
alcohol.
They always try.
So people were trying.
Of course. They don't want you to leave their team. The mob didn't want me to leave.
So people were trying to pull you back in.
They were trying to make fun of me. They even made a cartoon of me as a bum going through the garbage. You know?
So what is that like?
It's very upsetting and very hard to cope, to deal with, you know.
You're like 25?
24. Just turn, you know, and they didn't want me to leave, you know. Because when you change, they have to look at themselves too, you know. They don't want to look at that they may have a problem. But that honor amongst thieves and bullshit, they're all backstabbing scumbag.
How did you have the strength not to go back?
You know, I prayed. I had to turn my life and will over to a power greater than myself. And for me, the way I looked at it was like this. So I had this powerful God, right, that created everything, whatever. If he created everything, that would include evil. So if I'm afraid of evil coming to get me, because I was becoming evil, that's why I wanted to change. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the evil downtown Scotty Brown. I want to be more like Charlie Brown. You know what I mean? That's what I realized. I'm throwing these big parties, and the mob was like, dude, you're bringing too much attention to yourself. That's why I moved to San Fran, so I could just at least party and have fun and drive fancy cars. They're like, don't bring that attention to yourself in Chicago, you know, because it brings attention to us. So I was so sick of that. I didn't want to be that guy that's threatening his best friends with murder and threatening everybody in this, having this aim. I want to be a happy guy. I want to have parties. I want to dance. I want to have fun. So if God created evil, then he's got to be more powerful, right? So if I side with this God that's a good God, good person, higher power, boom, I'll be protected. That's all I could do was have faith that that was going to happen.
Is recovery just a few months sort of thing, or is it something?
No, it's still every day I wake up and have to start over again, it seems like. You know, in the middle of the night, something switches. It goes from I'm grateful to impending doom. Then I wake up with impending doom. It's like, another day. Oh, shit. I read my meditations for the day. Every day it says to me, you're not in charge. Take a backseat and enjoy the freaking journey. Quit trying to control it. Get into action, suit up and show up and live the dream. So that's what I do, not knowing what's going to happen.
Scotty, this period of time in your life was over 30, 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. When you look back at who you were then, before sort of the surrender and everything else, I mean, what do you say to that young Scotty Brown?
Well, first of all, I'm glad I was able to change. That guy is not a guy I would like today because he's very self-centered and egotistical. And, you know, I say like King Baby, we're egomaniacs with low self-esteem. And, you know, I'm still, that guy wants to come out on a daily basis because there's an aspect of it that was fun, you know. And I had a lot of fun. I love dancing. I love music. I still did. I stayed in that business because it's the other thing that I enjoyed and liked. You know, I just try to help others now, which is what I really wanted. I think everybody in life wants to be loved. And they think that maybe material things and people wanting that or to be around them for that reason. But that's not real love, you know. So really helping others is what I found. And I'm lucky that I have this, that I went through that stuff so I can help others to change, have that serenity, peace of mind, and glow that it gives you when you're able to do that. Now, you know, society and everything's not easy, you know. Living life on life's terms is not easy, you know. And do I want to be a big gangster running the show again? Sometimes. You know, there's something that was fun about it, you know. But it's not rewarding spiritually or on the inside where you really, you know, want. And when I got sick with cancer 10 years ago and people told me that I helped them save their life, that made me feel spiritually rich. And I'm okay with dying now, you know. Like I did what I could and I tried to make changes to help. I tried to be a trusted servant of God. And you know what, David? I'm on a mission from God. That's what I do now. And sometimes I forget, but he seems to remind me real fast that, dude, you're on a different road. Quit. If I become an egomaniac or whatever, he'll slap my ass down fast. I'll be like, I'm sorry. You know, I got to try to be humble. It's not easy for me.
So you did actually get involved with a rehab center.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did. You know, I came to Malibu and became a realtor there for the reason of trying to find a nice property. And I saw this one that had a little hair salon in it and it's set alone clubhouse with the apartments up above. And I thought, what a perfect place to have a clubhouse. Cause I like Alano clubs and stuff where people can go for fun and for free. And, you know, and I thought it was the perfect thing, you know. And me and my dad were going to get it, and my dad said, get one of your friends to do it. We had a falling out, and I got one of my friends to do it, and he's been very successful ever since then. It's been called Soba, and it's in Malibu on PCH. And the surrounding area became very beautiful with Larry Ellison building Nobu and Soho House and that whole thing. So my buddy made a lot of money. My dad and me missed out on the money, but I was happy that there was a clubhouse there and people – they still have meetings there every day for fun and for free and whatever.
How tight is the recovery community and support network?
It's very good, you know. It's great. I moved all over when I got cancer. I was like, Tracy wanted to go back home to Florida, so we went there. Wherever we went, we had instant family, which was the greatest thing in the world. And that, to me, the fellowship is one of the best things in the world, you know. Sometimes one door closes, but it's being in the hallway waiting for the other door to open that's tough, you know? And delaying gratification is one of the main things I learned, that I can't get drugs and sex, and those things are all instant gratification, you know? So I have to delay them if I delay gratification. if I want the really good things, you know, and take care of me and become what I want in a relationship or whatever. And that's been good so far. But it's a day at a time, you know. A lot of times I say it's a minute at a time. But God provides.
Do you have any shame or regrets?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of shame when I came in, but what I realized was that that's the disease also trying to kill me. Because I read this pamphlet called The Devil in AA, and that helped me more than anything. And it said, oh, now you're sober. Now you got to be hard on your kids. Now you got to change your life. Now you got to go back to school. Now you got to get that career your parents always wanted you to have. And it's so, your head and your mind is so hard on you that there's no way to survive it without using or killing yourself or whatever, right? And it said, that's the devil trying to get you back again, you know? So easy does it. You know, live and let live. Don't be so hard on others and yourself, because those are the people that are hard on themselves, you know? Did that answer the question?
Yeah.
What was the question?
Scotty, thank you so much for your story. Thank you for being open and very authentic. And you're such a fun guy to be around, but also this is a very serious topic, and I appreciate you being open with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What an extraordinary life story. If this story moved you, help enable our mission and keep this advertising-free podcast going by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. I'm responsible and accountable for this podcast, but I don't do it alone. Milos Brochetta is our sound engineer. Artie Wu is our advisor, and many others have helped along the way to bring the story to life. Thank you for listening. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. Thank you for rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend or two. Stay tuned. I'm working on some stories that you need to hear.